Do you want to learn how to invest, or are you an entrepreneur and want to build companies in the regenerative food and agriculture space? Or do you work in big ag and big food and want to really move the needle? We have developed a new video course for you. Find out more on investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/course or in the show notes description below. How a young chef became the personal chef of the Obamas, starting a vegetable garden in the garden of the White House. And not only that, but it got actually very involved and active in the food and agriculture policy space. After 6 years, he left and started focusing on investing and entrepreneurship, joining an impact VC. We talk about the potential of venture capital VC in this space, the challenges and the tensions that brings, and the real world, and why he argues we should focus our energy on getting everybody access to carrots, and of course a lot of other veggies, before we focus on quality and growing practices. Don't have the perfect be the enemy of the good, and have the whole food as medicine, nutrient density space become super elitist. Most people don't have access to healthy food to begin with, let alone nutrient density food. And why he thinks carbon and payments is a very interesting and real entry point to scale. Enjoy. What are the connections between healthy farming practices, healthy soil, healthy produce, healthy gut, and healthy people? Welcome to a special series where we go deep into the relationship between regenerative agriculture practices that build soil health and the nutritional quality of the food we end up eating. We unpack the current state of science, the role of investments, businesses, nonprofits, entrepreneurs, and more.
We're very happy with the support of the Grantham Foundation for the Protection of the Environment for this series. The Grantham Foundation is a private foundation with a mission to protect and conserve the natural environment. Find out more on granthamfoundation.org. or in the links below.
Welcome to another episode. Today with the former senior nutrition advisor at the Obama administration and current partner at Acre VC. Welcome, Sam.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And I mean, there are already many things to unpack in that little introduction sentence, but what led you to soil, to foods to begin with? And of course, then we're going to talk how you ended up being a nutrition advisor and why a president needs that. But and of course, also your step towards the investment side. But on the personal side, I always like to ask that question from all the career paths you could have taken and you could have walked into. Why did you, or how did you end up on soil?
Well, I'm actually a chef by training.
Okay, that was an easy one. Yeah.
And so, yeah, if you're a chef and trying to put the most beautiful food on the plate for whoever you're serving, then you're forced to start to think about the land which it comes from and the way it was produced, and both from a health standpoint, but also from a climate and sustainability standpoint. And so it was that relationship that really set me on my path ultimately to, first start caring about that and then start understanding a lot of the political and financial implications of how the system works, and which, led me to focus on policy for many years and now onto the investment side.
And I mean, as a chef, I think there are many that simply get their stuff wholesale, get it delivered to the back door at the kitchen, and of course, focus on quality, but not necessarily on, let's say, the practices of how, not because they have the time and maybe the mental space to think about it because it's a gruesome, many hours a day job. Like what triggered you into not just caring about the quality and the taste, what ended up on the plate, but actually connecting that back to what happened on the farm or wherever the food came from? Do you remember what triggered that, or was it a very natural process?
Actually, it was a very specific moment.
That's what we like in a podcast, so we can talk about it.
So I was actually, I finished my studies from the University of Chicago in Vienna. And while I was there, I got myself into one of the better restaurants in the city, and I was sort of working for free and learning how to cook because I was very interested in food. And And so there was this moment very early in my training where the sous chef had me make a rhubarb sauce for this foie gras dish. And they called me Inky, and he said, "Okay, do I have to keep it clean
No,
or
you can do whatever you
okay?"
want.
Okay, so
It's a podcast. We don't need to go on TV.
the sous chef, they call me Yankee. He's like, "All right, Yankee, cook the rhubarb down and then fuck in the butter." That's what he said. I was like, "All right, I guess that means put in a lot of butter." So I cooked this rhubarb down and I put a big old spoonful of butter in there. And he said, no, Yankee, I said fuck in the butter." I was like, "Oh, damn. Okay, well, that's a lot of butter." So I put another giant thing of butter in, and he came over to me and got right in my face. And he said, "If the guest walks out of here and drops dead of a heart attack, that's not my problem. The guests ask us to make food that tastes good, not that's good for them." And with that, he put this gigantic amount of butter in and walked away. And it, you know, so I go back to my station. You know, he was like yelling at me, and the whole kitchen like stopped and listened. And I was super embarrassed, but I also was like, you know, it was really upsetting because he was both right. Like,
And
that is
wrong,
true.
yeah.
Like, that was absolutely right. And that was so wrong. Like, something was so wrong about that moment. And I could, now, so I'm sitting there like reeling from this. And I look out into the dining room because I could, you know, sort of like a semi-open kitchen. I looked out at there and I just realized, like, God, like everybody out there looks like shit. Like, they look sick. Like, they don't, you know, they're not healthy. And so I start thinking about, okay, what are the implications of what I'm serving has on the, you know, well-being of the people that are eating it. And then right as I'm in the middle of that like line of questioning, the purveyor of all the ducks and chickens and eggs came and dropped this huge stack of product on the ground, and I and to my left, and I just, you know, they asked, "Well, I wonder what the implications are on the land and the environment and the soil and the people who are producing the food." And once I asked those couple questions of myself and started picking up, you know, weird policy books and history of agriculture books, you quickly got an understanding that, you know, food and agriculture systems are at the cornerstone of most of the biggest challenges we face. And that, you know, if you want to actually solve a lot of these problems, you have to transform, you know, how we eat. And, you know, the more I dug, the more like I understood that, and very much sent me down the path of like, okay, well, what can we do to start shifting policy and, you know, and shifting our culture and then working on the business side. So that it was very specific. It really was that moment that really changed the trajectory of my career.
So you came back to the States, and did you work in the restaurant world, or you went straight to policy after that revelation, or did you try to set up, I don't know, farm to table or deeply farm focused restaurant to change? Like, what was the step after that, or you realized actually I need to go into policy and then business to have a bigger change?
So sort of a combination. Like, I started, I really wanted, I was young. Like, I was, I don't know, 23 or something, 24 when that happened. And so I started, you know, I finished my time there. I started cooking and traveling around the world. And while I was doing that, I was like reading everything I could get my hands on around these issues and starting to really educate myself. And as I did that, I ended up coming, I came back, cooked in a restaurant in Chicago for a little while in the middle of that when I ran out of money. So back out on the road, did a bunch of private chefing, sort of, really developed my style, which was very health, you know, nourishing focused. Like, I don't cook health food per se, but, you know, food that is conscious of people's well-being. And then I finally, after like 5 years of kind of be out in the world, I realized, okay, it's time to, you know, maybe settle down a little bit and start building something. And so I came back with, you know, a desire to, I felt and still believe that chefs are, you know, maybe the most, one of the most, not the most important group of influencers on these issues, who we sort of sit between the producers and eaters. And we, you know, so I came back thinking I'd start organizing chefs around food policy and food politics. And also started to think about some businesses that I could start. I had a private chef company that's focused on, education and better food. That's when I started cooking for the Obamas. And so, during the just after
Super
he launched the
logical step,
campaign.
obviously. Yeah. Like you do,
Yeah.
like one does.
Like one does. Yes. So I cooked for them for 2 years in Chicago before they won. So I was sort of, it was a good fit, for somebody who was trying to get into food politics and figure out how to change to be cooking for them.
Of course, of course. But
So
you could
yeah.
also have continued to cook for them, I don't know, in the White House, and actually you decided or focused or doubled down on the policy side and on the advisory side, not necessarily feeding the Obama side, which is of course
Well,
essential.
I actually did both. So I both led food policy for him, and I ran her big campaign called Let's Move, which was their big childhood initiative. So I did the garden and all of her school nutrition work, and I cooked 5 nights a week. So they kept me pretty busy. So I was doing both while I was there.
And how did that second piece came? Because going from I'm cooking, I'm taking care of the food side, of course, and then but layering the other layers on top of that, was it a natural fit? And did they ask you? Did you at some point said, actually, I want to do more than just making sure you and the family are as fit and healthy and nourished as possible?
So it was a natural fit for them. I wouldn't say it was a natural fit for anybody else in the White House, in the beginning anyway. We had just, Michelle and I had discussed
As one does at the day, of course,
the
when you're eating food, cooking food, you start discussing. I mean, it's a very natural
yeah.
place to
Yeah,
discuss
we
stuff
spent
around the house.
hours. Yeah, we spent hours talking about everything and what was going on, and she saw the impact on her own health and her kids' health. And so that, I think really opened her eyes to what's possible. And also, we talked about all the problems that were happening, how much, American families were struggling on these issues. And, she realized that she was also struggling, and she was worried about her own kids. And that was somebody who had plenty of resources and very well educated, et cetera. And so we went to the White House basically with a plan that we're going to do this garden and sort of use that as a way to take the temperature of the country and, see if these issues really resonated. And then, if it did, then we'd do a big, broader health initiative to try to take on, the bigger issues around food and health and nutrition. And so, that's what happened. Now, there's never been anybody else in the White House who's had a role both in the residence as well as in the executive office of the president. So
That must have been easy.
that took some time to be, I'll never forget that, people were like, "You're the chef. Like, what are you doing in this policy meeting?" I'm sort of like, "You're some random policy person. What are you doing in this food and agriculture meeting? Like, what do you know?" You don't know anything about food. So,
That must have been an interesting meeting. No, of course, it takes time to everybody tries
it
to
just took some
stage
time for me to
their
gain.
role
Yeah.
and where what room do I have to maneuver or not, and everybody's worried for their own what do you say, their own job, not job, but also, yeah, of course, I can imagine a competition around in an office like that or in an institution like that, let's say with a gazillion cameras focused on you like never before. It's the boiling temperature is easy,
It's very, yeah.
it's intense. So how long did you do that? Like, how long did that combination, or also in general, were you very involved in that?
So I was in the White House for 6 years.
Must have been exhausting.
It was very
Intense.
deeply exhausting, yeah, and intense. And look, I mean, the learning curve for anybody walking in the White House for the first time is incredibly steep. Nothing really prepares you for a place like that. It took me a while to learn how to play the game. I mean, I was a pretty quick study, but it's highly competitive in there. I mean, you're sort of all on the same team and you're sort of all competing intensely to try to move whatever your issue is forward. And a lot of your energy is actually spent dealing, navigating the internal dynamics of getting anything done, getting anything like the impact. If you can get anything done, the impact is massive, right? You're dealing with these huge dollars, and in the US it's 350 million people, and any one little thing you can do can affect a lot of people, but it's really hard to get anything done. So that part, took me a while to sort of figure out how to navigate, but I figured I definitely made my way. But
What was your
it
biggest
took a while to.
surprise in there? Like looking back, and then what I'm going to ask your biggest accomplishment, but or were you most proud of? But what's your looking back now? What was the thing that surprised you the most?
Surprise me. I mean, that's a good question. I don't know what was like surprising.
Like
I
looking
mean,
back, like I would have never expected that, or that I would be doing that, or that would be a thing or an issue or not, or.
well, I mean, kind of the whole thing, dude. I mean, I'm just like a, kid from the South Side of Chicago, and that I would be, cooking for, Barack and Michelle Obama and feeding their family every night and running food policy for him and like digging up the South Lawn and planting eggplants and zucchini, and also, being good friends with them and sort of being really able to witness, pretty closely all that happened and all that they went through. I mean, the whole thing was not to be believed even now. I don't know. It's something I would say is like really surprising. It's just really the intensity of that place is very hard to describe. The stakes on everything you do is very hard to describe. And, being the first African American president and first lady, the scrutiny that we were dealing with was like unlike anything anybody had seen before. And, there was no margin for error at all. Like, we look at what's happened since, and like there was a big controversy because he wore a light suit. She got huge criticism because she wore shorts one day when she was in like 100 degree heat in a desert. Like, that was the kind of controversy
Yeah,
that
it's
we were
difficult to
dealing with.
remember that we, I'm saying the general, we were worried about considering what happened after and what everything else was suddenly okay. But and
So
your
anyway.
biggest accomplishment or what you're most proud of, sorry, not accomplishment sounds, but what you're most proud of your time there. Could be the garden, could be, of course, policy work. What do you look back to like, wow,
Yeah, I
we
mean, I
managed to get
think from
that done.
I'd say I'd say three things. Well, transforming school nutrition was a, probably the biggest accomplishment we had. That the standards hadn't been updated in 20 years, and there had been no new money in 30, I think, something like that. And so, that was a really big deal. We were able to get a lot of really important things done within that bill that, even with, a decade now of attempts to try to undercut it, it's most of it has remained intact, and hopefully we'll get some new, improvements to it in the coming year. So that one, obviously, I mean, it's, like 32 million kids a day are affected by that. So that one you got to feel pretty good about. We did a big partnership with Walmart that transformed a lot of key issues around accessibility and affordability of healthier foods, which changed the whole industry because they're so big that they were, if you have to change for them, then you kind of have to change for everybody. So that was pretty proud of what I was able to do on that one. I think the thing that gets the least amount of attention or credit, but that in some ways is the bedrock of all kinds of change that have come since, is we really focus on shifting the culture around food in the country, really elevating it as an issue that everybody should care about. When we got in there, it was, most people really weren't thinking about it. It was, advocates and were yelling at the food industry, and nobody was really paying much attention to it. And we tried to very, very deliberately put these issues kind of front and center, in the psyche and culture of the country, which is what is absolutely necessary as a precondition for policy to start to move
We
or for
don't care.
businesses to
It's not going to move.
start to care. Yeah. And still to this day, voters aren't voting on food policy issues, which is why, they don't get the kind of attention and change that we need. So we made a lot of progress, particularly like which is where you see all these startups and all this shift in the big guys. She is deserves a tremendous amount of credit for dramatically accelerating. You know, there was some good movement happening, but she really took it to a whole other level to make it a mainstream issue. And so we'll never really get the credit on that one that we deserve, but it's really had a transformational impact
And
in that
then,
regard.
why did you decide to leave policy and I mean, not leave policy, but go to the investing and the company or entrepreneur or business side? What made you transition?
I think what I came to realize is that we had been able to start either finish or start most of the big things that were possible, certainly at the time, particularly given the state of politics in the US. You know, you're not getting m much done. You're not getting anything really done in Congress. And so, and from the executive, you know, we kind of pulled all the levers that were within reason pullable. And that the next wave of change was going to be driven by entrepreneurs and innovations and technology that either were going to start replacing some of the big guys and taking market share from them, or, you know, you could utilize their scale to scale a better way of doing things. And that pressure and relationship is going to what move most of the industry. Because I do think the thing most people forget is, you know, obviously, the government has a big role to play in food and food policy, but ultimately, the government's not dictating what ends up on the plates of Americans. It's just not. I wish it was on some levels because it would be easier to change things
But then,
depending on who's in office. Like
the
the
risk,
next guy came, you don't want that guy deciding like that you have to eat like well done steak and, you know, pizza or whatever the hell he was. And so, you know, I think understanding and trying to shift the ecosystem that's really ultimately driving what ends up on our plates and how it's grown and produced, is why I decided to spend the next phase of my career on the investment side.
And yeah, how did you? I mean, of course, after a stint at the White House, there are many options. What made you choose a partner role at Acre? What made you choose an investor role compared to maybe setting up another company like you did before with private chefs? Like, what was the choice on the investing versus the investee side?
I felt that seemed to be a big opportunity on a couple levels. One, there was not a lot of mission-driven capital out there that cared about climate change and human health and broader environmental health.
And this
And
was
that
when
for
were we
me,
talking? Like, this was, so you did 6 years,
two,
2014,
like
15.
15 and 16,
Yeah, that was desert out there, probably.
And so, and I've believed and still do believe, and increasingly it's proving out that the companies that are solving these massive problems that are, you know, live within the food system are going to also outperform companies that are not. You're seeing that play out in within the portfolios of the big guys, like in terms of what products are growing, what products are not. And you're definitely seeing that from a capital standpoint. In this sector, it's not true in every sector, but in this sector, you know, companies that are solving some of these big pain points around sustainable practices, regenerative agriculture, healthier and more nutrient dense products, they're doing better than just the next. Generally, there's some exceptions, of course, but so it's not a 1-to-1 correlation, but generally, it's absolutely true. And so, I felt like there's a chance to, you know, try to build the companies of the future. And build the future of the food system. And we kind of had to do that because, you know, that ultimately is what does shape what ends up on people's plates and is going to, I mean, ultimately food and ag is a private sector endeavor. And either you get in the game and roll up your sleeves and sort of fight the fight in that arena, or you're going to be kind of on the outskirts trying to shape it and, you know, push it a bit, which has a big role, but it's not the heart center of what actually shapes
what we eat and why we eat it and how it's produced.
And would you say as an investor, you're at the heart of and center, or is it the companies you end up backing? Because you could argue you're still, not still, you're a bit on the outskirts, because at the end, the work what ends up on the plate, but you're very active as well, early stage investing, and you pick what you pick and you support what you support. So how do you see your role there?
Great question. Yes, on some levels, you're still on the outskirts. By taking this kind of role, I'm trading some breadth for depth, right? So instead of picking one company where you build and you're just all in super deep, and like I debate this because there's trade-offs, right? Sometimes it feels like, okay, I'm too spread and not deep enough, but you're still, if you're just doing one company, you're still relatively limited in terms of your ability to
and the
impact,
chances it doesn't work out, and or you're partly wrong.
It's higher risk in some levels, and it's in many levels, and it's also you're still going to be constrained by whatever the four walls of that company are. And you know, for me, being on a platform as big as the White House, sort of looking to get scale and having broad, big impact is something that I'll be chasing for the rest of my life on some levels, I think, even though I work hard to not. I can't shake the feeling of doing something really big that has a huge nationwide impact. Like there's nothing that can compare to that feeling. And so, I think the way the way I look at it and the way we look at it at Acres, we're high conviction investors, meaning we're not making like 50 bets and hoping something works. We find companies we really think could change the world and we really think can be successful commercially. And then we like go deep in and just really work our butts off on behalf of those companies and do everything we can to de-risk that investment for our investors, for our limited partners. And also, you know, try to help, you know, make the change we believe in. And so, you know, we really build alongside of our founders. So it's definitely a couple clicks removed. We are not this, you know, it's not my company, the ones that I'm on the board of, but I joke like, you know, one company called Planet Four is a wonderful company helping to decarbonize the food system with data and models and strategy around, you know, life cycle assessments and then strategies to reduce emissions through the system. And I joke that I'm her, you know, cheapest employee because I work for free, basically, for the CEO. So, you know, that's the approach. So I'd say it's somewhere in the middle.
And for the listeners, of course, I'll put the website below on acre.vc. Don't go now to check it. But just to describe it a bit, what is the fund or the funds? What's the size at the moment? What's the focus? You have a very interesting list of portfolio companies, obviously, but just for people to understand a bit what we're talking about when you talk about the platform that where you're spending your time.
Yeah. So Acre is where as I said, we're a mission-driven venture fund focused on climate change and environmental health, human health, and through food and agricultural systems. And so we look to invest, you know, from generally like seed through B rounds for companies that we think could have a measurable and meaningful impact on those issues that we care about. We'll look at anything related, even tangentially related to food and ag systems and nature-based solutions. And, you know, we sort of divide it up in these three buckets, although, you know, in the reality, it's a comprehensive system that, you know, is working in a very holistic and fluid way. So it's hard to sort of neatly divide them, but we look at sort of
agriculture. But you have to do it for your tech slides when you're raising. Yeah. You
need exactly. For the deck. Cost. Yeah. The deck. So it's ag and agriculture technology, food tech, like supply chain, investments, and then consumer, but we don't really do too much
CPGs,
like not a ton of CPG. We have a couple, but for the most part, we're not doing the next granola bar. We're looking for, you know, more underpinning innovations that could really unlock like the food as medicine space or, you know, the like. But I'm spending a lot of my time on climate right now, obviously, for good obvious reasons.
And we'll get to the food as medicine. And just in terms of length, is it the standard 10-year VC path, let's say? And two-part question, where are you in the journey now? And does our exits happening? And is it also creating tension? Do you see the timing? We hear that often on the podcast, not because I want to bash the VC world necessarily, but 10 years sometimes might not be enough or sometimes create tension. So let's start with the first part. Where are you in your journey? And do you see that tension sometimes as well?
So we're raising our third fund, which will be done by the end of the year. And fund two is we're investing out of fund three already.
And total money more or less deployed or raised, if you can, what you can share, of course, just to have an idea of size. It's not 5 or 10 million, I think.
No. Yeah. So like, we'll let's see, let's do the math. You know, we'll be at sort of like 250, 300 million, so like that 300 million or something by the end of this fund. Give or take a little bit. I think there's some challenges in the venture model for sure. I think the bigger problem is the quality of the people. And the...
You mean on the companies or the venture side?
No, the venture side. Yeah. I mean, you know, there are a lot of really good people who are stand-up. You know, folks have to run their businesses and sometimes make very difficult decisions, but for the most part, you know, are helping to build these companies and not trying to, you know, just pump them and flip them and, you know, not care about the long-term viability of the company. That's definitely not how we roll. There's plenty of those kind of folks out there, and you just have to be really careful about who you get into business with, like anything. So I think like there's some incentives in the VC model that, you know, can be problematic. And from a time standpoint, duration standpoint in the ag side, that's maybe a little even more acute because some of these things just take longer to build than say just a piece of software that you know, can sort of get out there. But on the other hand, like, you know,
we have 10 years probably.
Like, we don't got much time left.
We've had that conversation quite a few times. Like, yes, and at the same time, this is a model you can raise 300 million with and put it to work. So
And I just think, and I also just think, like, yeah, like, you know, the world's burning and dying, and we got to have solutions. Like, the pressure on speed, you know, the pressure to, like, build and really make progress, which allows you to raise an extra round, is like good. It forces companies to get, you know, tight and smarter and better and more efficient and develop technologies that are going to work. And you know, look, if something's not really working for some reason, you know, then the realities of the market take care of that. It's not to say that there's some great technology that haven't made it for bad, you know, for the wrong reason. So it's not a perfect system. But I think it's a little lazy to say, oh, all venture is bad. And, you know, it's all a problem because they just want to do it so fast. I'm sort of like, if you have a model or a piece of tech that you can't get scale in 10 years, it's probably far more often than not, it's probably, you know, not a company that's going to work ever. There's definitely exceptions. I'm sure somebody's going to write you and be like, well, there's this one company that
farming, but you're not talking about starting a farm. Yeah, that's a different.
Yeah. Well, of course. So like they had land and such, you know, and carbon projects. So there's lots of things that have longer durations that we should be thoughtful about and figure out how this kind of capital can work in a broader ecosystem. I mean, like, venture is not the only thing, but, you know, in fact, I think part of the problem is we don't have enough capital that's mission aligned and values aligned through the journey. So one of the things that does keep me up at night, it's like, okay, yeah, we can get a company to like the C or the D. But then you have some real assholes out there who, you know, will take advantage of any moment they can to extract as much value for themselves as they can. Now, there's also some wonderful investors who are later stage, but there's not enough of them.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you could build something really great and then you just run into a few months of a tough situation and you could lose everything, you know, and somebody else would just take all the value that you had created over 5 years and, you know, basically just take it because the company's in a tough spot and that capital has real leverage. Even if the fundamentals of that business are great, then, you know, and like you see right now, a lot of companies are in that situation and this next year is going to be really painful. And so, you know, I think that's a risk to keeping mission and values aligned through the growth of a company. And that's a real challenge that we face, you know, continuously. But you know, we're seeing some incredible entrepreneurs with solutions that I think and technology that I truly believe could transform the world and mitigate some of the worst of the climate crisis that we're facing, significantly accelerate a move towards regenerative agriculture, invest, you know, seeing some of the underpinning technologies for that, you know, and, you know, down through the health side as well. So, you know, I remain actually, it's the part of my daily experience that gives me hope. The rest is pretty, you know, it's pretty difficult when you sit and grapple with what the data is saying. You know, it's pretty hard to stay hopeful. But when you see some of the things that are coming, it gives me reason to believe we can mitigate the worst of this.
And talking on the food as medicine piece, or the nutrient density and nutrition connected to healthy soils, what have you seen there? Obviously, you saw it firsthand as a chef and then as a market gardener in the White House and as a chef there as well. But what have you seen in the past, let's say, 9 years, 8 years, we're recording this in the summer of 23, on that intersection, and what if gives you hope there or excites you from an investor point of view, but also in general as a chef and, of course, as a father and somebody that really pays attention to that beat?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think there's lots of different ways to look at it, at least how we think about it. You know, if you look at, I think lots of people like to go to like personalized nutrition and all this other stuff. Like for me, like the challenges are far more just basic and fundamental. When you look at the amount, there's a very convenient, nicely packaged narrative that says the reason why, you know, cheeseburgers are cheap is because of government subsidies and, like, you know, then why they're cheaper than a bunch of carrots. The reality of that is just, unfortunately, I wish that were true. It's just really not true. There's some really bad subsidy policies all over the world, and particularly in the United States, that are, you know, just inefficient uses of taxpayer dollars. And definitely, you know, helps to prop up a certain system. But it's considering the size of, you know, corn and soy production in the United States, it's actually a very, very small amount of money compared to, you know, what the economy that's been built around it. The thing that's been much more impactful over the last 50 years, the amount of research and innovation dollars that we put into the production of those two crops and our ability to grow them far more efficiently. Now, I put efficient in quotes because a lot of the impact of that has been externalized, so that, you know, production system.
But we pushed it within a current system as far as we could push it, basically.
Yeah, which means that, like, you know, we're just producing, you know, millions and millions of acres with, you know, only a handful of people producing it, because nobody has to be on the combine. You can grow, and, you know, you can grow, you know, 100,000 acres and never set foot on your field. And the amount, you know, and the yield that you're getting is pretty extraordinary compared to historical numbers. And so that has driven down the cost of those, you know, key inputs to that system. And from a, like, a dollar standpoint, statistically insignificant number of dollars, like not even register on the map, have gone into, you know, fruit, vegetable, and nutrient, you know, whole grain production. So that's why the cost is so different. So we are I guess it's not announced, so I guess I can't say it yet. We're finalizing the deal will be announced soon.
I will share the recording before, and you can sign off on it or not before it goes live. It will be somewhere September, October. So if it then doesn't go through, we can take it out.
No, it'll be announced by then. Yeah, it'll be announced by then. But yeah, we're just leading an investment in a company called Bonsai, which is automating tractors and farm equipment for orchard production.
Has nothing to do with small trees, I think. No.
Yeah, no. Because what you're saying is basically labor is a huge driver of the cost in these systems. And if we want to figure out both how to farm them more sustainably based on data, we're going to have to start figuring out ways to collect the data, which we don't have right now. Secondly, if you want to make sure we can bring the cost down or at least not have it dramatically spike as we enter an age of volatility, and grow, you know, figure out how to produce these foods, then we're going to have to, you know, reduce our costs of how we bring them to market. And that just hasn't happened yet in this part of the landscape. And so while there's real trade-offs, and I grapple personally, I come from a labor family. My dad was a big union organizer. I grew up on picket lines. It's a huge driver of cost. It's a huge driver of waste. So much food can't be harvested because producers can't find enough labor. So we think it's a solution that can be pretty impactful in enabling these healthier foods to make it to market at a price point that people can afford. So we're looking for those kind of scalable, transformational pieces of technology, not the thing that is going to be great for wealthy people in Manhattan, but things that are going to make sure that people all over the country and, you know, all over the world are going to be able to benefit from.
And the theme of healthy soil and the connection to, let's say, healthy humans or healthy gut systems, what have you seen there? What have you not seen that you would like to see? Like, what would excite you, especially making something or investing in something or companies that are not just for the happy few that live in Manhattan or whatever big city we can name? Like, what would be, like, how do we make that accessible? And of course, driving the cost down, but also that all the latest research on healthier soil practices start to connect that to healthier gut and healthier people, especially for the people that need it most. And somehow it just never ends up there. Like, what would be... Wait, what have you seen or what would you love to see?
I mean, I've seen, there's a lot of companies doing some very interesting work in this space that I've seen. I forget the name, there's a company that's basically producing live algae on farm and putting that in to really bed a lot of the biome of the soil.
Myland, I think.
Yeah, maybe that. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. I love them. I mean, I questioned about the scalability of that. We didn't do that deal. But, you know, I think there's some really interesting work being done in various ways. The company that I'm most excited about in our portfolio in this space is a company called Loam Bio, which is an Australian-based company that has identified fungi microbes in the soil naturally occurring that are sequestering between 1 and 3 tons of carbon per acre per year. And storing that carbon far more permanently in the soil. And that then leads to a much healthier overall, soil construction. Obviously that carbon is fundamental to the life within the soil. And you also, because of that, start to see a real yield bump because of the relationship that the microbes have with the roots of the plants. I think that company can, with any kind of scale, start to fundamentally transform the way we farm, start making the numbers for regenerative agriculture actually really work at scale. Like, there's some really amazing, beautiful, brilliant producers who have figured it out over decades and decades of work.
But we don't have that time for the rest of us.
Yeah. And I just, you know, we have to ask ourselves, why hasn't everybody done it? Right. And, if it's so easy and obvious way to do it, why hasn't everybody done it? It's not easy. It's not obvious. And the return on investment for many growers just isn't there. And there's also a deep culture in agriculture. So the root of how we even understand our culture that, is hard to overcome because people have been producing for a couple of generations in this way. And they have all kinds of systems that they've set up and invested millions and millions of dollars in these kind of ways of doing it with the certain kinds of equipment, et cetera. And that's hard to change unless the numbers make more sense. If it's like, yeah, maybe over time in 10 years, your soil will be better and you can make a little bit more money because you're getting a little bit more yield. That's not a story that's going to see broad scale adaptation of a different way of production. I think we need to make the numbers work. I do think that carbon is the way that's going to happen. And I hope
more
that
than
it
quantity
is
of flavor. Like, do you see the potential there for the nutrient density in the healthcare angle?
I definitely think carbon more than flavor right now, for sure. And I think over time, there could be, I think there's a lot of possibility around, you know, growing nutraceuticals and having food be more like embedded in the actual healthcare system. Are we going to start saying like the healthcare system will cover this carrot because it's growing better soil, has more nutrients than that carrot? Nah, that's not going to happen.
Why?
Because I think what we're going to start to see is like, we'll start covering carrots.
Let's start with
and
that.
That's a revolution. Yeah, like, and this is where I think we have to be careful. Like, you know, I just care about getting everybody a carrot. Because right now, a lot of people don't have carrots. And I think it's great for some people to be focused on how do we get the best carrot, how do we get the most delicious carrot, how do we get the most, you know, nutrient-dense carrot. And hopefully over time, that starts to flow through the system and so everybody's carrot starts to get better. But most people don't have a carrot right now. And we have to think about what we have to do to unlock the ability for everybody just to have basic access to these foods. And I do think the food as medicine opportunity the biggest unlock potential there to start to pull, better food and food as a cornerstone of our health and our healthcare system, and shifting from treatment to prevention. Like, that's the opportunity. But the reality is, like, you know, a little more or less beta carotene is a far less important than eat the carrot or not eat the carrot. And, you know, so that's what does get me quite excited. And I'm super, like, I'm a cheerleader for the rest of that work. And I think once we can start to,
let's not get the perfect be the enemy of the good. And
yeah, which plagues
all
progressives. Like, it is a disease of the progressive side of the world. And we get in our own way. We stop our own momentum because, we have this idea in our vision in our minds about how the world should be. And we then look at the world as it is through that lens. And I think when you're actually, what changed for me, like when I went to the White House is, and I, you know, all those idealists are, and writers and critics, people that, you know, in the US, I know most of them, I love most of them, you know, I respect them. But what changed for me is when you're then tasked for actually changing something, you know, you have to grapple with the world that is not the world that you want it to be, and start from the reality of the current situation, and then try to move the world towards your ideals, as opposed to starting with your ideals and saying everything's bad. So I think you know, soil health has so many benefits, like endless benefits, and it is the right thing to really focus on. And yes, we will get better flavor, which will drive traction on certain parts of the system. It will be better nutrition, which will be unlocks in other certain parts.
You're saying a better unlock is carbon than, let's say, the better carotene in a carrot.
I think in the short term, the biggest crisis we face, which will undermine everything else that anybody's working on. If you're in national security or in education or in criminal justice, or like literally there's no issue that is not going to be significantly undermined and impacted by climate. So for me, the biggest existential crisis that the globe has ever faced is climate change. We have we really only have a handful of years left to keep this from spiraling beyond our ability to control. We're getting really close to that day. And, you know, I don't also think that there's any other technology on the planet that is going to be able to sequester enough carbon in the time horizon and the sciences we have than agriculture. It's the only system that has a shot at this, to buy ourselves enough time.
Mm. But it still doesn't mean carbon will be, I mean, it should be, but it will be the key to unlock a lot of change, a lot of hectares and acres of change.
That's correct. And largely right now, at least in the US, that's true because like there's problems, right? We have still, you know, technology need improvements on the measurement side. There's permanence questions, which loam is, you know, solving part of the reason I'm excited, because it does lock the carbon in far more permanently than just practice-based changes. So it's not without challenges, but right now, you know, the carbon markets are being, you know, under siege because there's some bad actors and there's been bad credits, and I understand the critiques of those systems, but the reality is, I think it's kind of our only hope. And if oil and gas companies want to pay to transform a food system to be regenerative based, you know, I'm fine for that for the next 10 years. And then we can work to then, you know, fully transition our energy systems and bring on carbon capture technologies and the rest. But that stuff's going to take too long. And we have to start pulling carbon out of the air. Just reducing our emissions is not enough. We've long passed that line, in my opinion. And so that's what I think is going to drive the most. I think there'll be all these other benefits. And it's not a debate. Like for me, it's like, it doesn't have to be an either or. I will support any effort to try to improve the quality and flavor and nutrient density of the produce that we're bringing, because the science is pretty clear that both as the climate shifts and soils have been eroded, the nutrient density of the, you know, vegetables that we have also erodes, right? So that's also true. So I don't think we need to get in the trap of like, which is better. I do think that the economic return, I just know how these big food companies work. They're not going to pay more money for that nutrient dense carrot. Now, a wealthy consumer at a farmer's market like me, who like will pay literally $40 for a chicken down the road, literally, like that chicken lives a better life than I do, and I pay $40 for it. But I mean, Jesus, $40 for a chicken? I mean, nobody can pay that. And you know, so you know, I think we just have to stay rooted in the reality of how most people are living, and create the path for all of us to help us move and produce change, but not say that like everybody has to believe in the brightest orange carrot or it's not going to work. You know, I don't think that's how it goes.
And then I want to be conscious of your time, so a few final questions. What would be your main message, of course, without giving investment advice, but to investors that are coming into the game now or coming into this space, the food and egg space? What would mm-hmm. be your main thing? If we do this live in a theater, and of course they're excited after they learned a lot, but if you could put something in their head, one thing they remember after they walk out of that theater and hopefully the next morning go to work on it, what would be that one message you would like them to remember?
Well, it's hard to say one. There's many messages. I mean, I think given the size of the industry, the scale of the problems and the opportunities, you know, this is still a woefully underinvested sector. Get in the game. First is get in the game. Like, we welcome people in the game. We need a lot more people in the game. Is one. And, you know, two, I think, you know, look to forge partnerships or relationships with people who actually know food and agriculture systems, because I'll tell you, there's plenty of people who sort of like just come in and out, and they're making some bad decisions, overvaluing companies wildly because they don't really understand the sector. And that's not good for the sector, right? You're going to have a lot of companies have a bunch of pain and lose momentum and may not be able to raise money because they were wildly overvalued. And you know, not sensitive to duration and capital intensity. And that's bad because one really good companies who could have made it are probably not going to make it. So I think we just have to, you know, people got to get smart and knowledgeable about, you know, this part of the investment, you know, ecosystem. And then I'd say my last piece of advice is like, if an entrepreneur has no idea or experience or anybody on their team that's deeply rooted in agricultural systems or food systems, like my very free advice, take it or leave it, is walk away. Because farmers, like if somebody says,
I'm going to sell this amazing tech to farmers and I've never set like, foot on a farm. Yeah.
I
read in the McKinsey report they're the least digitalized sector, and I make this amazing platform, and I'm like, oh god, there we go again.
Exactly. I will bet 1,000. I'll give you 1,000-1 odds, and I'll put everything in my bank account to say that that company is not going to work. It's the first thing we look at.
We see it constantly,
all the time, every day, all the time. So you know, it's a very specific industry with specific
doesn't mean
kinds
we don't
of people.
Need new people from that have experience elsewhere to come in, but go and spend time with
absolutely
farms.
Right.
Go and listen. Go and ask a lot of questions, and partner with people that are
and hire. Yeah, partner. That's exactly right. That's really important. You got to partner with people. Have people on the team who like come from that world. It's very different to like research and try to study it. To like, I mean, I spent my life in this space, right? But like when you talk to somebody who like grew up on a farm or worked in the big ag companies, like they're different. Like they know it with a different level of fidelity than even I do. I've spent 20 years working on these things. And so you have to at least know what's real, like know the real from the fake and know, you know, how you get the right people around to navigate it. Cause it's very complicated and the incumbencies are very powerful and very strong and it's hard. It's not that hard to build something small and beautiful. I mean, it is hard. Everything's hard. But like building something small and beautiful is doable, right? It's the question of how do you build something that's good or great that's scalable. That's really hard. And for me, if we're not bringing these solutions to everybody, then what's the point? Like what are we doing here? It's simply not going to have the impact that we need. So
good advice. And then flipping this way, I mean, in one way, not that far off, but I like to ask the question, maybe the next fund you'll get there, but what if you had tomorrow morning $1 billion under management and this could be any duration as well. So it could be partly land, could be as long as it has been invested, maybe a small amount could go to lobby if you really want to, but I'm asking this question usually to see what somebody would prioritize. Like what would you, I'm not asking exact dollar amounts, obviously I'm asking what would you focus on? Is it full on ag tech? Is it more the consumer side? Is it the policy side for a bit of lobbying? Is it land funds? What would you do if you had 10 or sorry, not 10 million, if you had $1 billion to put to work, like a lot of
this
money.
Is great.
Could also be 10.
This is the best fundraising call I've ever had. First you offered me $1 billion, now you offer me $10 billion. This is a
lot.
Incredible.
Like I
want to
be like resources almost unconstrained, like an amount that's not the issue. The issue is what you focus on.
I mean, I'd say I put two hats on. If I was still in government and I had $10 billion, I'd put it all into research around soil, nutrient density, different crops, better genetics for healthy food.
To catch up a bit of the lag we have with,
I think it's the only way. From an investment standpoint, you know, I would probably, I would really focus my dollars around starting with carbon, but moving into more nature-based solutions and natural capital frameworks. And you know, the underpinning technologies that are needed to really make that work, and probably definitely have to earmark some of that for the policy infrastructure that's needed. And that's both within government and also within the nonprofit world to set up the kind of standards reporting mechanisms that are not clear and not there yet at all. And it's a real problem in the industry. But I do think that that's the most important opportunity that we're facing. There's a strong critique on just focusing on carbon. I totally understand that critique and don't think it's wrong. I do think it's sort of the first step. And so I would work to really
What are the next steps? Biodiversity, water, what are you excited about beyond carbon?
Biodiversity and water are the next two for me. All underpinned by healthier soil, right? So, you know, I think healthier soil is a really sort of bulletproof place to focus and start. It affects all the outcomes that we're looking for. But I think to set up a functioning system, you got to start with something that's simple and easier to measure. And biodiversity is really tough to measure. And, you know, so it doesn't mean we shouldn't keep working and trying. I'm totally with people who on the critique of, you know, problem has been we've been too reductionist and that's going to get us in trouble again. Like, I get that, but I also see no other way forward. And I would invest heavily in making that a reality.
And as a final one, if you had a magic wand and could change one thing overnight, so I'm sorry we took away your 10 billion fund, but you do have a magic power, but one only. What would you change overnight?
I really resist that kind of question because, you know, it's just not how it works. And I don't think it leads us to think that there's just like one thing that like could magically do it.
And no, like, it could be consciousness. It could be actually getting food and ag into the minds of all policymakers, or something that you wanted to do and you've pushed quite far. Could also be better taste, better developed tongues. I mean, could be, that we see, I don't know, the carbon leaching or the water quality before our eyes, or something absolutely out of this world, which won't happen, but still would be an interesting, would be fundamental if that shifts. I'm not going to force you to answer, obviously, if you don't want to.
Well, I mean, I guess in that regard, I can say one thing that it would be, would imply a lot of other changes have happened. So yeah, if voters said that climate change and food and agricultural systems were in their top three or five priorities, that would be transformational around what policy would do. And you would also then imagine if those people care about that enough to vote on it, they also will be caring about that in terms of what foods they're choosing to buy, what companies they will buy from. And that would have the, you know, a major transformational impact on those companies. So what I'm saying in that is that you have a cultural transformation, which leads into an actual, a true movement, which has not happened before. Yeah. So by saying that that all voters would care about it, I'm implying a far bigger shift, but that would be represented in that magic wand's ability to make everybody say it's
it is a magic one of my most important. It's a magic wand, so it's possible.
Man, I should come on this podcast more often. I'd come away with $10 billion and a magic wand. This is great.
I want to thank you so much for your time and obviously the work you do and coming here to share about it. And of course, good luck with the third fund and deploying that. And good luck with the journey so far, or good luck with the journey going forward.
Thank you so much. Real pleasure. Talk again soon.
Thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. For the show notes and links we discussed in this episode, check out our website, investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/posts. If you like this episode, why not share it with a friend or give us a rating on Apple Podcasts? That really helps. Thanks again, and see you next time.